This is an interview with Ted Shannon, who is actually Theodore Shannon, and who is going to be talking about extension. This is the 26th of May, 1988. I'm Laura Smale, doing the interview for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Archives Oral History Project, and we're talking in the oral history office in the Red Gym. I'm particularly interested in the period around the merger of extension, but you've been here since 1950.
Right.
So if you have something to say about the period before then, you're welcome to. I know you were born in Connecticut.
That's right. Yes.
Lebanese parents.
That's right.
Right.
You do remember, do you? Or how did you know? Maybe
well, I've ask. Been looking into files.
Ah, yes. Right. Sure. Yes. As a matter of fact, I came here from Connecticut. I was doing my graduate work at Yale and came here before I finished my PhD and finished it while here. I don't recommend that to anybody.
How did you happen to come here?
Well, the then dean, Lawrence Adolphson, you doubtless know, was looking for an assistant in 1950, and he talked to a colleague of his, Bob Fleming, who was here at that time as director of the Industrial Relations Center. And Bob and I had known each other for some years in the Army, both here at stateside and then later overseas. He happened to talk about this need for an assistant with Bob, and Bob knew that I was finishing up my work in education at Yale, and he said, ha-ha, here's a chance to give him a crack at this job. So Adolph asked me out and interviewed me, and then one thing led to another. Mm-hmm. I was interviewed by E.B. Fred. In those days, the president always interviewed people. And I was offered the job of, well, I was offered two jobs when I came out for my interview. One was the director of lectures and concerts, the old Lyceum Bureau that goes way back, almost to the beginning of the Extension Division. And the other was this job of assistant to the director, which had not yet been worked out. The other one was a job in place, but had been vacated. And I turned that one down. At the time, I said, gee, I don't know what that's all about. He said, you know, it provided programs for high school assemblies and that kind of thing. And I remember at the time being puzzled about it until I got home and thought about it. Of course, I'd had assembly programs most of my life, that is, most of my high school days. You probably remember them as well, when they brought singers and lecturers and scientists and adventurers and all this kind of thing to high school. Well, I did turn down that job in the hope that the other one would materialize. It did. But when I got here, I got them both. So I wound up with two jobs at the time. And then a third one was added, and a fourth one was added. And then I went through all the administrative ranks or administrative positions in extension for the next decade or so, with the exception of director of the extension centers. That's the two-year centers run.
Yeah. Do you, you knew, you were working in adult education. That was what your PhD was in, is that right?
Originally, my PhD was in teacher education.
Oh.
But I had been interested in what I had seen of adult education at what is now Southern Connecticut University, which was then the New Haven State College, or State Teachers College, located in New Haven. And I've been intrigued with what they were doing in the way of adult education. And as a matter of fact, for a while I was doing a project with them, but it hadn't occurred to me that that would be a good, I mean, it just hadn't occurred to me that that'd be a professional pursuit until I came out here, and then I was just blown away by what I saw here. This is just what they were doing in 1950, was just fabulous. I had no idea that a university was doing as much as the University of Wisconsin was doing. And getting back to what we were saying earlier about the golden period, that really was a golden period of extension. The University Extension Division was one of two extensions at the time, as you know. The other one was a the Cooperative Extension Service, CES, of the College of Agriculture. And they were really two parallel agencies which rarely ever met. I mean, they went their separate ways. But what the University Extension Division was doing was just, it was something I hadn't ever experienced before, hadn't heard much about, heard a little bit about the Wisconsin idea, but I didn't realize they had these institutions for carrying out the idea. And as a matter of fact, I would have to say that looking back at the history of the University Extension Division here at Wisconsin, when it was created in 1906 or 1907, depending on what date you want to pick, it really revived the extension movement that had existed in the United States and had sort of died off at the turn of the century. And from that time onward, Wisconsin was probably the foremost institution in general, what we now call general extension work in the nation. I don't think there was a period from, let us say, from 1906 until the merger that had ever lagged behind any other institution in the country. Mm-hmm. Maybe not as large as some of the others, but for its own size, it was very considerable, its programming. I think California naturally exceeded it in enrollments and numbers and offerings and whatnot. But in terms of substance and resources devoted to extension and subsidies provided by the legislature, no one could touch it. It was really a remarkable institution. And it was started with a lot of support from outside the university. As a matter of fact, if it had depended on internal forces to create extension and public service, it's my continuing certainty that it would never have gotten going. I don't think the university proper, that is the faculty of the institution, have really thoroughly embraced extension. I think it has taken an instrumentality set aside somewhat from the day-to-day activities of the university to provide it continuity and institutionalization. Mm-hmm. It was started by people outside the university, by influences of people outside the university. And I think it continues to this day to attract support constantly from the first constituency, which is the taxpayers. Mm-hmm. The rest of the people tend to deal with the children of the taxpayers. Extension has to deal with and produce for the taxpayers themselves. So it tends to stay pretty close to their interests and needs. I think even today, there are very considerable constituency support for extension and public service. Probably more support outside than inside institutions.
Yeah, it expanded very rapidly around the late 40s, early 50s. Now, was this, how much did Adolphson have to do with this, and what was his leadership
right.
like?
I think Adolphson was, there were five deans of the University Extension Division, starting with Reber and ending with me. And I think the two key deans throughout that entire period were Reber and Adolphson.
Okay.
As I say, there were five deans, and I think because he was the first, Louis Reber and the architect, Louis Reber was a very important person, by the way, he shaped the institution and built up support for it. But I think that the really golden years came under Adolphson. Mm-hmm.
And this was due to him?
I think very much due to him and his style of administration, his vision, and his openness. Adolphson, for one thing, he got his degrees here, his advanced degrees at Wisconsin in political science. And so he was a Midwesterner to begin with. He was born in Chicago of Scandinavian parents. His mother was Finnish. His father was a Swede. And he attended Wabash. He came up during the Depression and had a pretty rough time with a fairly large family, but I gather a very close and caring family, and had pretty much made his own way. So he had by that time picked up a very broad political philosophy. I think all of his instincts were progressive and what we would call liberal today. I think progressive is a better term for it. And while he hadn't really built a broad and deep educational philosophy, there's not that much difference between politics and education in very important respects. And particularly when you get to the adult and the extension and the continuing education, there was, I think, very genuine understanding of the public issues. He was an astute thinker, I think, an excellent speaker. In fact, I think speech was one of his strong points. I know that it was at Wabash. He won a lot of debates and speech contests and whatnot. But he was a very careful observer of what was happening on the world scene and in the national and state scene politically, and had built up his own political philosophy, I think, a very sophisticated political philosophy, which stood him in good stead, I think, when he was making educational decisions, because he dealt with the public sector all of the time, outreach, the extramural student. He had to be sensitive to what was happening beyond the university. He was very receptive to ideas. I remember a professor coming into his, and people used to come to him to try to solve problems that the other parts of the university could not solve. He was receptive. He was gentle. He just sort of attracted people who had questions or problems. I do remember, as I started to say, a professor, now retired, who came in and said, "Adolf is the only dean whose first answer is not no," who never uses no as his first answer, and then you have to turn around, cajole, and argue and whatnot. In fact, sometimes I think his answer was yes, a little too often, too hasty, yes. He was receptive to ideas and notions. And another professor once said, "He's the only one around here with stature for whom you don't have to do a ceremonial dance when you walk into his office." He was really a... I don't know whether you ever got Adolf on tape, but if you didn't, I'm very sorry.
Well, the reason I asked you that question as to whether it was his doing was that I did talk to him on tape.
I do remember you telling me that.
And it wasn't, in my opinion, a very
right
good interview because he didn't seem to be very interested in...
I do remember you saying that. It was sometime after he had retired,
yes.
I think. He was then not very well. And he was out of it, sort of. Mm. That is, he had sort of... His mind had drifted away from it.
He was very pleasant and willing to talk, but
very generous.
I didn't get a sense of somebody who eagerly looked back on his...
Right. Career. I had once asked a fellow who had interviewed an old professor of mine at Yale how he liked him, because I remembered him as a very dynamic and a forceful guy, and he said, "He's a marvelous man, but he's a spent volcano," he said, about this professor. It was a Britisher who was saying this. I thought that was a neat, felicitous phrase. And in some ways, Adolf was a spent volcano.
But was he a volcano at any time?
Well, yeah, I think that's probably not an apt analogy. Actually, he was a force, though not, he was not volcanic by any means, that's right. He was a strong, steady, always present force. Adolf had, I think for most of his colleagues, especially those younger than he, I think he He was sort of a father and a brother figure at the same time, interestingly. He was a very comfortable guy to be around, and he was solicitous of people's welfare and their families and their concerns. Gentle. I think by the time you talked to him, if I'm not mistaken, it had not occurred only at his retirement, but there is plenty of evidence, I think, that once he spun off from Extension and took over the center system, which theretofore, you know, was only a portion of Extension, and even though his position was elevated, first to the provost and along with all of the other campus heads who were called that, and then later to chancellor, I really think he felt a little bit dislocated. I don't know how happy he was with that spin-off.
Do you know the story of it? I mean, I know it happened, but do you know?
Sure, I can tell you what I'm convinced is the story. I know what I was told was the occasion, but which has since been modified by Bob Clodius. Harrington, who was a very dynamic president, as you know, and I think I could easily say probably the best president in my time. I came here when E.B. Fred was president, and Ira Baldwin was his long, faithful associate and vice president. He had a good administration, A.W. Peterson, and he had people on the faculty that he worked with very closely. But, you know, E.B. Fred came off as a kind of bumbler, though most people thought that was just a style, that he was a pretty clever fox under all of that, old farm boy, old poor old professor, misplaced in administration, dying to get back, that kind of thing. Adolf was named by his predecessor, by the way, by E.B. Fred's predecessor, Dijkstra. But Adolf really never felt comfortable with E.B. because he represented the old guard under whom Adolf had grown up as a grad student, after all. And he never had made that transition of going from graduate student to a full-blown dean when E.B. Fred was there. Under Connie Elvium, I think he felt a lot more secure. That was short-lived, of course. Connie didn't last that long. And in many ways, Connie was much more conservative than E.B. Fred, though. E.B. gave the impression of being a very conservative, sort of almost rural type. I don't think he was nearly as conservative as Connie was. In fact, I think it was Connie's conservatism that eventually killed him, if I may say that. That's another story. And Fred Harrington was Connie's vice president, as you remember, and he'd been sort of relegated the humanities and the social sciences. He took them as much as he was relegated them. But it's just as well, because I think they were in the doldrums under the scientists preceding him. And he did a tremendous job of building up those, and lots of others. I don't think anybody on the scene could have coped with the enormity of the changes that occurred, the post-war changes, and then the troubles that came on, the terrific building expansion of the campus and whatnot. Fred was able to handle all of that. One other thing about Fred, it's a long-winded answer to your question, but one other thing about it was that he had done his homework for being president of this institution because that was what he desperately wanted, as you know. You were here, I suppose, during the period when he was trying very hard to become president and was aced out by Elvium by, I think, a single vote in the Board of Regents, and then tried for a whole bunch of other presidencies. Finally landed one at Hawaii. Connie Elvium died, and then the regents unanimously sought his release from Hawaii. But Fred had studied to be president here, and one of the things he had studied was which were the strong departments and which were the weak departments, And how could we take advantage of the strong departments to help build up the weak department? That's in a manner of speaking. And he recognized quickly that Extension, because of its national stature and whatnot, was really a strong institution here, and that he could depend on it to help bring up this institution all together. At the same time, having studied Extension as carefully as he had, he recognized that in the long run, it would not do to have two eventually competing extensions on the spot in one institution, because over time, in those latter years, the two extensions were beginning to run into each other. Now, I'll give you my version of how they ran into each other. As you probably remember, we were losing farms at a fairly substantial clip from the post-war years onward, as a consequence of which the clientele for what we used to call agricultural extension was dying off, falling away. And increasingly, as they lost their clientele on the farms, they began to move into probe other areas of opportunities. And that was a clear directive from the USDA, of which they were a part. And then they had a big professional staff, and they were a nationwide institution, whereas the University Extension Division here was one of, sort of belonged to an association, but it had little except associational connections with the rest of the institution, whereas cooperative extension was an integral part of a nationwide system of extension. They had federal monies and whatnot. But what was happening was that they were beginning to move into the urban places. And there'd been a rough urban-rural division between constituencies theretofore. But as the rural places became more urbanized and the people in the rural places were falling away, then ag extension began to follow them into the cities. And in those efforts, was starting to bump into the University Extension Division's undertaking. Not that we were ever exclusively urban and rural, because the University Extension Division had people all over, small towns, large towns, through correspondence study dealt with people in the rural places, and our entire outreach effort reached both. And theirs did to some extent, but they were more particularly agricultural oriented. We don't talk about them as ag extension any longer, but that's all we called them in those days. And we don't because they have very systematically and successfully moved away from their very tight orientation to A, the farmer, B, his wife, home economics. See, that was part of the College of Agriculture in those days. And the dean of home economics was really not a dean. She was sort of an associate dean and reported to the dean of agriculture. And then 4-H, which took care of the farmer's children, either the boys to become farmers and the girls to become housewives. I mean, it was a very neat and tidy arrangement. That began to evaporate. That whole formula began to dissipate. So Fred could see clashes coming down the road. In fact, he had to arbitrate some of them in his time, and his predecessors had begun to as well. And he asked himself, along with other administrators, you know, why do you need two machines here? Why two mechanisms? And why not bring them all together in one very substantial and strong, I must say, co-op extension here, likewise had national stature, was a very good example of ag extension in its time. Now that we've got these two stellar institutions, you could hear Fred thinking, I'm sure, why not bring them together? Why have two? And then we can combine other things, radio and television, and all of the outreach activities and the adult education activities. If you looked at the budget of those times, it was a little messy in that there were pieces of adult education and public service in various places, and it was a natural inclination, I think, on his part to try to bring these together. Now, he also hoped at the same time to generate federal funds for the General Extension Division, the University Extension Division, is to match federal funds for co-op extension. And there were, and he helped, he and Adolphson and others of us, helped mount a national effort to get a general extension bill through the Congress. Worked like hell at it. I mean, Adolph spent a lot of time down there. I spent time. McNeil later spent time. Harrington spent a lot of time. It never came off, as you know. What we finally got instead was Title I of the Higher Education Act, which was not exclusively a University Extension Division bill. In the process of combining these, he knew that he'd have a real political fight on his hands with agriculture and its still considerable political clack in the state. And internally, he had to deal with Glenn Pound, who was a force to be reckoned with as Dean of the College of Agriculture. And he felt that in removing, what he was going to do was remove ag extension from the College of Agriculture and create it and bring and patch it together with the University Extension Division and then with radio and television and create a whole new force here, that the act of separating ag extension from agriculture was going to be such a political hassle that he had to prove that he was also balancing that with some other act directed at the University Extension Division. And that act was the removal of the two-year center system from extension and setting them up as a separate entity. And in doing that, let me say, I think he very substantially weakened the University Extension Division. And that was one of the contributing factors, I think, to its, what I'd have to say is its decline, subsequent decline. There were a couple of other things that happened that contributed to that, too. But having created this structure, having spun off the center system from it, or the two-year centers and creating them, in, having created them into a center, a system of their own, he needed a director for it. And he asked, or Adolph asked me whether I would take that on, and I really didn't want that. My heart was really an extension. So he asked and leaned on Adolph to take it over. And Adolph, being the good soldier that he was, and I agreed to do it. I think he was sort of sorry to end this career of his, but he'd been in it for 20 years. And as the head of the Extension Division, and I think he probably saw this as a new challenge. But quite frankly, I think over time he became less and less enthusiastic about that post. I was then named as his successor. As you know, I was by then the associate dean of the division. I'd been named that, I think, in 1960. And I really don't think, I think he did a good job, particularly in the early years of putting it together. But I think a kind of era had closed for Adolph. And I don't think he was ever as happy in that post as he had been in extension. He was wallopingly happy in the extension position, particularly as he was able to bring in new young people with a lot of energy to support his program.
So definitely wasn't a kick upstairs, a feeling that he wasn't doing as well for extension.
I don't think so. I think he was respected nationwide. I think Fred Harrington respected him. I think Clodius did. There's reason to think that they wondered how fast he was moving, I suppose. But golly, he had brought this extension division to a very high place in the national scene, and they had really little or no reason to be disappointed in him. I think later on they were less enthusiastic about his center system role than they might have been. And I know the subsequent administrators thought that you know, the system wasn't as dynamic as it could have been. But I keep thinking that wasn't his first choice either. I mean, that's not what he had hoped to do. He was, as I said, a good soldier, and took that on. We continued to work quite closely. For one thing, we continued for a while to share the same department. You know, Adolphson had built a departmental structure within the Extension Division, which paralleled a good deal of the internal structure of the university proper, particularly in letters and sciences, but not exclusively, in some of the other colleges as well. And there's a whole history of how that was built, and it was to my mind a very imaginative and workable structure. So for a time at least, we continued to share the departmental structure, particularly the heads. The same people who went over to be heads of the departments for the center system were also heads of departments for us in the University Extension Division. And then we tried to continue, you know, we used to use the centers as bases for our extension programs out in the field. They were natural places. The directors of the centers, as they were called then, were members of our staff, and so we used to have a lot of working relationships. It was an integral part of the Extension Division. But gradually we drifted away, the two units drifted away. Adolph and his old friends in the Extension Division never drifted away. They remained quite close and quite congenial. Those were friendships that were built up over the years, and they really never did dissipate. So. Adolph, too, by that time had become a bit of an elder statesman for the university, and I think he continued to be consulted by persons inside and outside his shop. But I have to say, I think there was a gradual decline in the dynamism of the center system and in Adolph's effectiveness as chancellor of the system. His health began to decline, for one thing. He had, as a young man, had tuberculosis and had overcome that. But he finally developed a heart problem, and he had bypass surgery, and then cancer. Mm-hmm. He was an inveterate pipe smoker. He smoked pipes all the time I knew him. And after his stint in Turkey, he smoked cigars for a while. But
these were happening while he was still
while he was active. I think that's right. It's a little foggy with me. I don't know whether his bypass surgery had occurred by then. Maybe not. Maybe there was just a general decline in his energy levels and his health, which eventuated in his heart problems and his lung problems. I'd have to reflect on that to be sure, and I'm sure we can document whether it was. But I'd have to say his energy levels and his health levels were in decline as he approached retirement. Now, you might know more about the circumstances of his retirement than I do, as a matter of fact. I have since heard, but long afterward, that people encouraged him to retire. I don't know whether that's occurred or whether that's been reviewed or reported. I don't have that on firsthand. He and I never discussed that as a possibility. We were very close, I must say. I had great admiration for him and real affection and respect. And as an administrator, I have to say that he had a philosophy of finding the best people he could possibly find and then giving them all kinds of freedoms to do the kinds of things they wanted to do. And they were so challenged by this kind of circumstance that they would cut off their arms before they disappoint him or embarrass him. You know. Mm. And people were just genuinely respectful of him and affectionate. He was a very likable gent. And I think because, and he had few hang-ups. He didn't have great vanities. He could let other people take credit if they wanted to take credit. He rarely lost his temper. Rarely lost it. In fact, I'm not sure I've ever personally seen him do it. His wife has said on one or two occasions that, like she said, all those Swedes, when they lose their tempers, go bananas or something like that. But he had a very equable personality and administrative style. He was very pragmatic. I said earlier that he had a real political sense of things, a progressive political sense. His instincts were all progressive and excellent, in my view, being a radical of sorts, me, that is. But he didn't let ideology confound events. He could ride with things. He always knew where he was headed, I think, politically, then I'd have to add philosophically. And he could take events as they came and then shape them to his own ends pretty well. He could do that remarkably well. He was a softie, as you might sense from the things I've said. He sometimes offered people jobs that he terribly regretted but was too embarrassed to undo, and then some of us had to undo those. I mean, he was such a kind guy that when people were in trouble and they came to him, he sometimes overextended his generosity when he didn't have the resources entirely to do it. But the other thing I have to say is that in his time as dean, the financial resources of the Extension Division were very sunny. We had, we built up surpluses because we were looking to build a building. We didn't have a place of our own in all the early years of Extension. We were cowbirded in one place or another on the campus. And I think that would be a fascinating study in itself. Where were the departments of Extension located on this campus? At one time, I remember counting 17 separate locations.
Where was yours?
This is fascinating. When I came here in 1950, the Extension Division was in the Home Economics Department, that building behind the Middleton Medical Library there up on the hill, on the Ag campus.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was the Extension Division. It said so on the building, but it was the Home Economics Building, and the Home Ec people were terribly unhappy that we had that whole thing, you know. In fact, they built a wing around us on the other side. Franny Zuhl, who was the last dean of Home Ec, you probably remember Franny, a real fire eater, a strong pre-feminist, I'd have to say, though they were bounced around. You know, those women were kicked around by the College of Agriculture. Franny Zuhl helped us lobby the legislature to get a building so we should get the hell out of her building. You can imagine. But in that period, we were building up surpluses because we'd been told if we could build up enough, get enough money, we could use it to build a building. Well, as it happened, we got the surplus up, and Walter Kohler came along as governor and wiped out our surplus. And it took an appropriation subsequently to get our building, which is the University Extension Division built that building on Lake Street.
Mm-hmm.
But our financial affairs were quite good. The legislature was very generous. It really believed in the University Extension mission, in the Wisconsin idea. As I said earlier, our constituency came from the outside, and our support came from the outside. And so they were quite generous with it. I'm sure there were times when we were up and down. There were times when we didn't get what we wanted. And during the Depression, I'm sure that Extension didn't fare nearly so well. But in the time that I remember, let's say that golden decade of 1950 to 1960, which was what I think was the real golden period that you were referring to earlier, we were in pretty good shape. Also, we had the United States Armed Forces Institute. That is, it was located in Madison during the war because we were here, and we had what was, I think, the outstanding correspondence study program of the country, maybe of the world. I think you could say that. And so they built the USAFI headquarters here in Madison, downtown Madison, and we handled their major contractual arrangements for course writing and course supervision. And we weren't the only ones. Other institutions had them, but we were the key institution there. And that contract, or those contracts, generated substantial income for Extension, as much by paying for a lot of our expenses that they were properly charged to them, as for the income that was generated to provide us with additional funds. And so we, for a long period of time, had resources to do a lot of experimentation and to venture. We had venture capital in a way. I don't mean that we were profligate or had so much we didn't know what to do with, but we were comfortable financially. And we did a lot of experimenting. We, for example, Extension brought the first person here in the field of the elderly, in the field of aging. We brought him here. We had him up in Wausau. We pioneered the whole business of alcohol abuse, for example. We ran conferences here. And that started up things for the university subsequently.
Were these Adolphson's ideas or some person's?
I have to say they were Adolphson's. Adolphson should take credit for it. They weren't all his ideas, to be sure, but he brought here a collection of people. He was constantly looking for bright people to bring here to help in the fostering of the Wisconsin idea, to help in the discharge of the obligations of the University Extension Division toward its very considerable constituency. And so, he created a climate of receptivity for new ideas. So it was a very sparkling and bubbly and exciting time to be working here. And of course, all of us thought that was the best part of the university, you know, to be sitting at that crossroads between intellect and action. That's what we always thought of, you know, ideas and practice. And it was a very exciting place to be. If I had to choose any other place, that's where I think I would have chosen even. And I had opportunities to go elsewhere or to move elsewhere in the university and whatnot, but I couldn't imagine giving up the excitement of being right there halfway between, you know, the intellect and the practice out here, internal and external. That whole thing, you know, it was very exciting. And they weren't necessarily Adolph's ideas, one after the other, but he created that climate and he brought together those minds and those energies and made the resources available to them that erupted in all of these very exciting programs. I mentioned aging, I mentioned alcoholism, consumer affairs we did a lot in. We created a center which we then located in Milwaukee. We helped in the, God knows we helped build up UWM. They don't acknowledge it and didn't during at the time, but we told our associate dean there when we first created the post, our last associate dean, Fred Olson, who was a member of their faculty to begin with. Now look, you build two institutions. You build Extension in Milwaukee, rebuild it, because we were there to begin with, as you know. But also at the same time, you helped build UWM. So we were, after all, apparent to a number of these agencies. You could look upon Parkside. After all, we had Racine and Kenosha centers there, and those were displaced by the creation of Parkside. In Green Bay, we had a substantial center there, and that was removed and became the Green Bay campus. Those two were created before the mergers, you know. Mm-hmm. That was before Lucy merged the two. We had those. Those were our, that is, University of Wisconsin-Madison,
yes,
campuses, as you know. There wasn't any University of Wisconsin-Madison. It was the University of Wisconsin. So we were sort of a parent agency to a lot of these things. And Adelson's force, quiet without pyrotechnics, Adolphson's force was there operating all the time. His presence was there, and it all, much of it happened because of his, what I think were his qualities of person and mind. Yeah, he was. That's not where we started with the question, though, is it?
Well, that's good to have your description of him. I have a few questions which would have to do with his, and they're kind of random.
Sure.
In the early 50s, there was problem with the School for Workers, and that was part of Extension.
Sure.
And they were being criticized for being less leftist and socialist. And
that was before the 50s, actually. A good deal of that happened before the 50s. By the time the 50s, when I remember I came in 1950, the big problem with the School for Workers was the directorship. It had a director by the name of Schwarzstrauber, who was then ill and in California. And it had an acting director who very much wished to become a director. And Vidkun Ulrichsson was his name. Mm-hmm. And he was the only one who wanted him to be director. I have to say that. I don't think the labor movement wanted him, and I know the university administration did not. I don't know what they, why they felt this way, unless they felt he was sort of a rambunctious bull in the china closet. But Adolf's problem was he had to bridge that period and eventually name a director. That was a serious problem with the School for Workers in those days. I don't think I remember much of this other hassle. Now, on that very point, let me go back a little bit. One of the reasons for the creation of the Industrial Relations Center, of which Bob Fleming was a director, was not in Extension, you remember.
Mm-hmm.
It was outside Extension, was to try to be a balance wheel between the School for Workers and the School of Business, which were constantly at each other. Old Fay Elwell, who was a fire-eater, anti-labor man, I'm sure, and who had spun his school out of the economics department prior to my coming here, but who was sort of the right wing of the labor management relationship. There was a lot of sparring there, and there were a lot of dirty tricks perpetrated on the School for Workers around the state that preceded this period. Where people were spies, were put in their classes, and disruptions took place, and that sort of thing. Bob Fleming's center was created to try to balance out these forces of labor on the one hand and management on the other, School for Workers and the school business. And we had a business department in Extension, which tended to reflect the views of the School of Business. So we had internal troubles of that sort. And there may have been some residual hassling in the early part of 1950 or the 50s. But those weren't, as I recollect, those weren't significant. I better go back and see whether that's accurate. I think those tended to precede 1950. Now, one of the ways that the problem was solved, Bob Fleming left in 1952 to go to a like position in Illinois, a much more important position, an entity there that was a lot more important than this. This was sort of almost an arbitration entity here. I think he was a one-man show. But when he went down to Illinois to head up their Industrial Relations Center, he had a staff and programs and whatnot. And that was before he was brought back, as you know, as the first promised of the Madison campus. The way Adolf finally solved the position of directorship was to name Ed Young as acting director of the School for Workers, then later director of the School for Workers. And Ed was a graduate student who had just gotten his PhD, and he'd worked under Zelig Perlman and Ed Witte, both of whom had been very influential in both the creation of the School for Workers and its continuing well-being. And Ed was recommended as a person sort of like Bob Flemmie, who could calm things and put things in order and whatnot. And a lot of politicking was done with the labor movement to get Ed accepted, and he was acceptable to them in time because they wanted to resolve this problem too. And once those things were in place, then Ed could continue as, he doesn't say much about his having been director of the School for Workers at one time, but he was. Yeah. And in order to qualify for that, he had to lean on his bona fides as a labor leader of some sorts, maybe in the strawberry fields of Maine or some, or the blueberry fields or someplace at that time. But that was his first full-time position at the University of Wisconsin. He was the director of the School for Workers in the Extension Division. He went from there to the chairmanship of the Department of Economics, which was in terrible shape in those days. And again, he was put in there to help shape it all up, which I think he did very satisfactorily. And then subsequent to that, Bob Ozan became director of the School for Workers, and he remained director until just fairly recently, as you know. And he kept things on a pretty even keel. He was a rather conservative administrator, and labor people weren't spoiling for a fight at all. They just wanted to be left alone. And I have to say that the hotheads on both sides began to recede in the real world. We didn't have these rabid anti-labor types, and we didn't have the rabid anti-management types to plague us in that period. So it was a fairly tranquil period. Although when you're dealing with a place called the School for Workers, I mean, nobody else has a School for Workers anymore. You're dealing with pretty hot problems. There were always efforts to convert it into something like an industrial relations center. That's a model that a lot of universities have created, which homogenizes management and labor interests, and you have neither fish nor fowl typically in situations like that. And neither labor nor management wanted that. I think maybe management wanted it more because they saw it as a way of reducing the presence of labor here. And I have to say this about the economics department. While they were very happy to have seen it created and to see it flourish, they were anxious to spin it off to some other. They didn't want constantly to be saddled with a School for Workers and then to be identified exclusively with the workers of the world. No, I mean, they were an economics department. They weren't a workers department. So that they found it very convenient to have a receptive administrator in Adolfson who would say, sure, we'll take it on. We'll do it. Same thing happened, incidentally, with the creation of the what's the thing that Bud Sharp runs? The Survey Research Center.
Lab, yeah.
Yeah, Survey Research Lab. It started out as an idea for the graduate school. You probably want to take that.
Yeah.
We were talking about School for Workers. I'm not sure you asked me about it, but.
Oh, and then you were talking about the Survey Research Lab.
Yeah, right. Survey Research Lab was created as an entity of the graduate school. And it had we brought a director here. Because it was really meant to serve the survey research interests of researchers of the faculty. But there are all kinds of political problems, internal political problems, both within the institute and between it and the grad school. an extension was asked whether it would take it on, and we said sure.
Goodness, what's the story on that? I didn't.
I mean, I know it.
I remember the first director, the fellow named Reese. You know, I'll have to either refer you to someone else who has a better recollection of it, or I'll have to rack my brain very hard to see if I can remember that story. But eventually, this I can generalize about extension using this as an example. Extension became a very useful instrumentality for the university proper. It did a lot of things that the university had to get done and had no other machinery to do it with. Some of it was pure and simple service, and some of it was out and out academic, and some of it was in between kinds of service. For example, because we had such an enormous need for printed material, correspondence study, bulletins, books, publications of all sorts, curricular materials, text material, and whatnot, we gradually built up an enormous printing capability. You know, this printing facility down on, where is it now?
Murray Street.
Right. That was created by extension, first with a little Ozolid machine and a couple of mimeographs and then larger and larger machines.
Wait.
Go ahead.
This is tape two of the interview with Ted Shannon.
Okay. Well, as I was saying, we kept building larger and larger capabilities in printing and whatnot. Same could be said for photography. We built the photo lab. And then later, the Bureau of Audiovisual Instruction was likewise useful to the campus as well as to the extension outreach function. Those are good examples of the service functions we provided to the university. Incidentally, Henry Dewey can tell you a lot about the buildup of that publishing thing, because he was sort of its angel. He shepherded it, I guess, maybe that's a better word. He kind of shepherded it and its growth and protected it when it needed protection. But we soon became the major, maybe one of the major, maybe the major agency for the university to get its printing done. So extension played a useful internal role as well as its useful teaching external role, public service role externally. And then on the academic side, it did the same thing. I mentioned a lot of the subject matter that extension pioneered eventually in behalf of the university proper, aging, drugs, consumers. We did a lot of that. And if I put my mind to it, I think of community development, which was later taken over by Ag Extension, and part of that wrestling match that I referred to earlier. And then out and out academics, with the assumption of responsibility for the Survey Research Lab, which was really a service agency for researchers of the university who had no survey machinery available to them. So this was created really by the graduate school, but eventually located in the extension division. And it's never left. I mean, it's in extension now. Its character has changed considerably, and its funding procedures have, but it's still there. Another one just came to mind, too. The legislature created an international cooperative training center meant to be located in the College of Agriculture, but the college didn't want it. The co-op people in the college didn't see any need for it, and particularly at that time, they weren't oriented toward the international front of the university.
When is this approximately?
It was about the time that Connie Elvium died, because I can remember this about it, that we had recruited a director for it, the first director, Adlo Larson. Does that name ring a bell? I'm trying to think of how we had recruited him. I'm trying to think of that. And I was to take him up to see Connie Elvium. We still had a practice of taking our major new administrative personnel up to see the president, sort of get the blessings and so forth. I was in our business office awaiting something when we got word that Connie had died.
Well, that fixes it all right.
Right there, that fixes it, doesn't it? Yeah. So you figure out, I can't tell you the date, but my recollection is I was waiting for Adlo to finish something up in the business office, and we were going to head up to see Connie when we got the shocking word. The president, I thought the president of the United States at the time, it turned out to be, you know, it was just that kind of alarming report. So we, all right, we created, so that was created and accepted by extension when the administration embarrassedly came to us and said, my God, you know, we had this thing, I think they worked with the legislature in creating it. Jerry Voorhees had helped start it up. He was a, you remember him, the California representative, the representative from California whom Nixon attacked as a left-wing fellow traveler and so forth. If you think back, you'll remember the name Jerry Voorhees.
I remember the name, but I wouldn't remember.
He was very active in the cooperative movement and had become very interested in co-ops as something to export to developing countries and to get them institutionalized as helpful mechanisms in development. And he wanted a training center someplace, and he thought of the University of Wisconsin as, you know, this marvelous place. And he and the legislature and the administration worked all of this out, only to be rebuffed by the College of Agriculture. So we said, sure, you know, we'll take it. So, I mean, it was such a brilliant idea, such a great idea.
I mean, the money was there.
The money was appropriated by the legislature, and then monies were raised by the national co-op, the national co-op people, mm-hmm. who raised considerable funds for this. And I think then the State Department and what the predecessor to AID, unless it was AID then, and other donor agencies then helped support bringing people here to be trained in the cooperative movement and cooperative administration.
Gee, I've never heard of that.
And sending people from here abroad. Oh yeah, there are still people here. The nature of it has changed. It's not any longer international, as I recollect. I've been away from it, as you realize. But there are one or two people here you may want to interview on that. Mary Jean McGrath is one of the last remaining persons. She came in toward the end of that international phase. And I don't know whether she's retired or not. She's just, you know, she's in the... We still have a cooperative center here, a training center. Frank Rose is, I think, still head of it. I'd have to look at the directory. But I don't know that it has that substantial international character. At that time, it was exclusively international. Mm-hmm. It was meant for third world country people to come over here and learn about co-ops. And then to do consulting and training overseas as well. I imagine it was a fairly successful venture. That's something you might want to look into. It's an interesting historical development. What took us to that?
I had asked you about the School for Workers.
That's right. Oh, God. I took a ride on one idea after another.
That's what's supposed to happen.
Okay, as long as it's supposed to happen.
I have another, just again, nearly random question from the early period, but there was the man named Hanley.
Sure, Wilbur Hanley.
Who was the head of the center system, I believe.
He was the head of the center system for a while. Yeah, for a while he was also had, as I recollect, he had three responsibilities in the very early days. Wilbur's, Bill Hanley's still living. You may want to interview him. He's got his own, I'm sure he has his own particular view and slant of this entire development. And I think for purposes of historic accuracy, you may want to talk to Bill. When I came, Bill was, I think, acting, he was in charge of the two-year centers. He was acting director of correspondence study. And he was, I think he was still director of the credit class program that we had, which was separate from the special class program, which I took over early on, which was a non-credit program. But we had a very substantial credit program, not nearly as large as non-credit, but substantial credit, mostly for school teachers, but not exclusively for school teachers. And in those days, they saw it as a rather natural connection to have the two-year center program related to the credit class program, which we offered. Now, most of the credit classes we offered were graduate level classes for teachers who needed continuing education credits for advancement. We did also teach undergraduate credit classes for persons who wanted to complete their baccalaureate degrees, and later for nurses in training, and for nurses who wanted to complete the degrees, and a few other professions, social work being one, but I think mainly for public school teachers. And then remember, we had, at that time, we still had two-year normal school graduates, and they had to upgrade their diplomas to degrees gradually over time. We provided a lot of those classes. And Bill was director of credit classes to the best of my recollection at that time. Subsequently, that moved over. But yeah. Now, Bill Handley pretty much remained director of the two-year centers until they were spun out of Extension and Adolf was put in charge of it.
What was your opinion of him?
I thought he was very candidly, I thought he was an able person, very sharp, but a loner who didn't like to share decisions with anybody, and who made unilateral decisions, even sometimes excluding the Dean of Extension, much to his embarrassment at times, to Adolf's. And I must say, unhappiness, I'd have to say. But he ran a very taut ship. He managed the center system as an integral unit, and he could patch together pieces of jobs for people in this center and that center, and then he'd have them commuting, a la Hayakawa in the old days, you know, who was one of the center teachers, or I guess Lee Dreyfus. Or because he was also director of credit classes, and if I'm not mistaken, he would also be able to patch a credit class to round out a job, or a correspondence study course assignment or something. He was, I think I'd have to say he was a very clever manager of that entity, which he took over sort of on his own and for him, just for himself. He was a one-man operation, and he played everything pretty close to his chest. I'd have to say, though, as I'd have, I think he was a competent and able administrator. But in this larger picture of bringing in new people, expanding new ideas, opening up horizons and raising the ceiling, Bill tended to be sitting off in the corner, sort of working his own little entity outside that stream. He was quite an opinionated and strong-willed person too, so that there were frequent occasions for disagreements. I don't think they ever got disagreeable particularly. And he wasn't always able to exercise his will, because there were a lot of other people who were making decisions as well. But he was there, and there were other administrators around the campus who weren't too fond of him because of this sort of egocentric, that's too strong a word, that's not really what, he was sort of a one-man show, and he made decisions irrespective of other people's opinions very often, and there are some people just couldn't abide them.
Did you know of any pressure on Adelson to get rid of Hanley?
Oh, I'm sure there are always, at times, there must have been some. I know E.B. Fred wasn't keen on him. I think they crossed swords at times. I know Guy Fawkes, the dean of the College of Education. I don't know if you ever knew Guy, who was a brilliant, tyrannical person and a story by himself. There are people who are around whom you might want to interview and get some of the flavor of that era, too. One of them would be Cliff Little. Have you ever interviewed Cliff?
He's been interviewed by...
Has he? Okay, well, Cliff was his deputy for years and years, was Guy's deputy, and was a great moderating influence on John Guy Fawkes. A lot of stories about Guy Fawkes I could tell, but one of them is he always warned me never to bring Hanley over to his office because he couldn't abide him. And then he would go on a sort of a tirade and tell me what was wrong with him. And there are other administrators. I don't know whether Fred Harrington ever wanted Adolph to get rid of him, but I don't think there was any love lost between Fred and him. Perhaps if you interview Fred, you might, or if I suppose you may have, you might learn that. He wasn't universally liked, but I have to give him his due. I think he was bright, and I think he did a very competent job, although not collaboratively. You know, he just, and as a consequence, he didn't fit in. There wasn't this, you know, people didn't think of him as so much as a friendly colleague as they did with most of the other people. It was a very open congenial group of people that Adolph brought about, gathered around him, with the exception of Bill. But Bill was here before I came. And let me just say, as long as we're talking about that, I do believe that bringing me here was a step on Adolph's part to cut down on Hanley's influence. And I was probably one of the first, and there were others later, to sort of dilute the administrative responsibilities that Bill had, and it was a way of diffusing that power. I'm convinced that one of the, not bringing me, but in creating that post, I should say, of assistant to the director, because that post quickly converted into a lot of other things. I went through a whole range of responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Almost from the beginning, I became director of special classes. I think Bill had that. So this was in being assistant to the director, Adolph could share with me some of the responsibilities he had perforce shared with Hanley. Then I became director of lectures and concerts of the Old Bureau Lyceums, lectures and short courses. I had a variety of names, and then later, when the chair of our education department had a stroke, I was asked to double in brass for that. The rest don't really... Well, yes, I became director of the field of field services, and that included all of the outreach with the exception of the two-year center. So, in a sense, in bringing in and expanding his administrative structure in that very early period, 1950, perhaps a year earlier, a year or two more or less in that period. What Adolph was doing was beginning to diffuse the administrative authority around the deanship and remove it from a dean and one-man operation to a multi-centered structure. I guess I'd have to acknowledge that in some ways Bill seemed to be a challenge to the dean's authority. If only because, you know, he just made these decisions quite on his own.
How did he react to your coming then?
It's a good question. I'm not entirely sure I know. I know that he talked with me a lot in the beginning. He interviewed me a lot. I don't mean before I came, because I don't think Adolf... I don't know whether Adolf dialogued with him about my coming. And I have seen, after all, I've seen the dean's files, because I was dean subsequently, and I've seen all of the memos that Adolf put in the files. I traveled with him quite a bit, and as I looked back on it, not just today, but lots earlier, I have reflected on the possibility that what he was trying to do was sound me out and see what kind of a guy was coming aboard and what this possible adversary might be like, but I don't know how to react to that. I don't know that he was any more cordial or less cordial to me than he was to anybody else. I made it a point to orient myself to the dean. Mm-hmm. And the only time I can remember an out-and-out clash was in the naming of the dean of, I don't think we call him dean yet in those days, the director of the Green Bay Center. And I do remember this now. Hanley insisted that there never be a person with an education degree, big E, as dean of a center. He always thought of as director of a center. No, that can't be right, because there were directors. Henry Arnsbrock is a case in point, and maybe some others. I'd have to think about that. Anyway, that's not entirely right. I know he did not want a big E education man as director of the Green Bay Center. And some of us had put forward Ted Savides' name. And Bill Hanley opposed that out of hand. And besides, he said that was his business and nobody else's. After all, he was in charge of the centers. Now, I don't know whether he had said that he didn't want a big E education man there, or whether he then said that in order to block it. But some of us by that time had come, as a matter of fact, had hired Savides in a number and had had him do work for us and knew he was a first-rate administrator, a guy with terrific imagination.
How do you spell it?
Savides, S-A-V-I-D-E-S. His last administrative post, another guy you ought to interview, his last administrative post was as dean of the center at Baraboo. Oh. Theodore Nelson Savides, S-A-V-I-D-E-S. He's there most of the time if you want to interview him or suggest he be interviewed. I'm sorry you're leaving. He'd be a good guy, excuse me, for you to interview. You'd enjoy him. Did a lot of imaginative things and was by that time ready to take on a deanship or a directorship. And some of us proposed him, I think Wilson Thede and I. I see he might have been. I don't know whether he was a student of Wilson. No, I think he was a student of Bert Kreutmoser. Hanley opposed that out of hand. And we joined the issue right there. And Adolf didn't know what way to decide. I mean, he was just torn. And Hanley stirred up all of the chairs of the department, too. After all, were not education chairs. They were in substantive fields of math and engineering and all the other things. And he sort of had them corralled. But we stood our ground on that. And interestingly enough, Hanley came around and offered Savides the job surreptitiously without telling anybody. I mean, he just succumbed on that one. But not until Adolfson had almost threatened to resign if the damned issue wasn't solved.
Wow.
Yeah, and that really was a blow to these other chairs who had taken Hanley's side on this thing. And they all backed off. Hanley backed off by offering Savides the job, and I think it was the right thing to do. I can say that despite the fact that I was a party to it, because he did a superb job at Green Bay and then subsequently at Baraboo when they created that post and he took it over. So that's really the only out-and-out clash that I remember directly with Bill. I'm sure there were occasions prior to that when we had very sharp differences of opinion, but those were administrative differences. I don't know that there were any personal animosities. There might have been. But, you know, if my father used to have an expression about a guy, people who are hard to get along with and who are always argumentative and whatnot, as a person who carries his ladder sideways. You know, I always thought that was marvelous. A neat picture in my mind, you know. And in some ways, Bill was that kind of guy. You'd have a group of relatively young, Bill was older than we, but relatively young, enthusiastic, fresh administrators popping off all these ideas, trying to make things go and shooting for the stars and whatnot. And here sat Bill, you know, smoking his pipe and not being at all impressed with any of this, and constantly sort of shooting these balloons out of the air and whatnot. But it worked all the same. And I said in the beginning, I think he was a very competent guy. He was very well read. He was a geographer by profession. His PhD was in geography. I think he was a very able geographer, but he was read in a lot of other fields as well. He wasn't some rustic, even though he raised cattle in the Baraboo Hills. He was a pretty astute individual. Now, there may have been other animosities between Bill and Adolph, and it would not surprise me if I learned about them. And there are a lot of people who sort of needled Bill and needled and complained about Bill being so rigid and structured. But I never saw it as a real drag on the division. It's one of those things you put up with.
And how much, I don't know whether this is an appropriate question, how much flexibility was there in how the centers would develop? Might they have gone in another direction from what they did?
Yes, I think they would have if Bill had not been director, I'm sure. For example, there's a very strong push on to make them community colleges, as you know.
Oh, yes,
Wisconsin,
right.
Epitomized the it was a polar situation. There were people who very strongly believed in community colleges, and then there were people who didn't believe in it at all and who hated the notion of community colleges.
Yes, I remember reading, I've forgotten, there was a very bitter issue.
Very strong issue here and nationally.
Yeah.
Very interestingly, I was personally caught up in it in that my brother was the vice president of the American Association of Community Colleges located in... or the executive director or something, located in Washington. And here I was at the university extension division, which epitomized the opposite, the other pole, you know. So we used to get ribbed a lot about representing these two poles. But it is true that Bill and, I have to say, many others resisted the notion of turning these things into community colleges, which would have meant that they would have been far less these feeder institutions for the university system. Although they weren't that exclusively, they were that very considerably. People who went there, when they transferred, tended to come to, well, in those days, Madison, and then subsequently elsewhere in the system. Because, you know, the state colleges also created two-year centers as well. Right.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, I think it is, I think it would be true to say, and you ought to ask Bill this question, I suppose, if you interview him, that he, as much as anybody, resisted the movement toward the creation of community colleges, the conversion of the two-year centers to community colleges. That might have meant some kind of merger with the vocational school system, which is now a post-secondary system, but which, when I came here, was not a post-secondary system, was still a secondary school system, was sort of the dumping ground of the public school system. That's another whole story that ought to be, well, I'm sure has been examined, but ought to be examined even more. And we might not today have this dichotomous problem between the vocational school system and the center system if there'd been any movement toward the creation of community colleges. I'm not, or junior colleges. I'm not making a judgment here. I'm just suggesting that Bill very clearly resisted any effort to change the two-year system from what it was, namely the freshman and sometimes freshman sophomore
program. A more academically oriented program, is that right?
Exclusively academically and preparatory, that is, you might say, a transfer program to the University of Wisconsin or to other universities that would accept their credits. That for one thing. For another thing, I think you'd have to say that some of the centers might not be located where they are if Bill hadn't put them where they are. I think he had fairly strong, maybe unilateral, influence on where the two-year centers were to go. And that had a very serious and marked impact
that is interesting.
On the present-day structure of the university, as you know. My guess is we would find, in the main, very pragmatic reasons for their location. That is, you can't have a center if there aren't students. That's one way to look at it. And if there are enough students, then you ought to have a center, and you can make this kind of...
These are his reasons, or these are AR should-be reasons?
No, I'm just saying that I would guess that these are the reasons he would cite. You know, how could... He would not... These were obviously the right places to put centers, because then you had students there. And if they were the wrong places, you wouldn't have had students, and they would have failed. So, clearly, in retrospect, one might argue, sure, there were centers there because that's where they should have gone. But I'm not sure that that's the only consideration that the state would have put in had it been a deliberation on a larger base. Or even the closing of centers. I think it was done a little more cavalierly than they might be closed today. Also, when the university administration made moves to close certain centers, Bill thwarted them politically in the legislature.
Now, when is this? This must be before 65, obviously.
Before
Adelson was made chancellor, yes.
Sure. Oh, yes. This was while they were still in emanation of the extension division, you see. Agency of the extension division. As I said earlier, he was sort of a one-man operation, and he ran the thing I suppose you think of the old time, what do we call them? The guys who run industry.
Religion.
The old time industry, you know, the one man shows in industry, the old what do we call them? We're not talking about robber barons, but there's another term for these guys who, the self-made people who made all the decisions and who, you know, that was a management style at one time, and Bill had that style. It sort of faded out of the picture in industry and business, but we had it here. Wisconsin had for a long time these family corporations, which turned into big, giant, multinational corporations, were still being run by some guy who had founded them, you know, or the son of the founder or something, but we don't have many of those left. And Bill ran things with that kind of style, you know. He was the boss, and he made the decisions.
So he was creating competition with the state universities, presumably, where you put some of these centers. Isn't that one of the problems?
I shouldn't be surprised, although in those days, the centers, the two-year, the state universities did not have centers. They came along a little later. He was still director, but well, the days I'm thinking about,
but
no,
I mean,
that's not so.
No, but he,
that's not
for instance,
so.
Didn't he put a center near where there was a
oh, yes.
state university?
Oh, yes, yes, we put one in Marshfield.
Marshfield.
Marshfield's a case in point. Menasha is another case in point. But some of these were not unilateral decisions on his part. By the time we put one in Marshfield, there was a big political and administrative machine operating. Because that one was a big hassle between Wood County and what's the other county that Stevens Point and Marshfield are? Wood County, and I've forgotten the other one. There was a big, giant fight then. The legislature got into the act. As I recollect, the governor got into it. The president of the university was in it. And so it went later with the creation of the of some of the other centers. But earlier on, let me see, I think when I came, Fond du Lac was still a center and was dropped. I don't know whether any of the others were. Manitowoc, I'm trying to think of all the centers we had in those days, and I think Fond du Lac was the only one that was dropped when I came. I'd have to go back and examine whether everything I've said is precisely accurate with regard to creating centers, because now when you mentioned, when I mentioned Marshfield, I do remember there are a lot of other people involved in that.
There were 29 centers in 1946.
Well, by the
then
time
a lot of them were dropped.
Yeah, by the time I came here, I think there were only 9. Could that be? Maybe 8. Do you have a?
I've got a note. 8 community colleges is up in the state, 1956.
Well, with that's it? What they call. Maybe somebody has called them community college, but they were not technically so that. Colleges in the communities.
Yeah.
We used to call them the freshman sophomore programs. Yeah, I think there were 9 and then 8. I think Fond du Lac was a 9th, and then they dropped Fond du Lac, and I think there might have been 8 then. If that's a question we want to determine, we can do that pretty easily.
Yeah, 29 centers in 1946, by now reduced to 8, 9 new two-year center buildings between 1960 and 1965.
Oh, well, what had happened was on that score, we didn't have any of our own freestanding buildings.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have our own campuses. We put our freshman sophomore programs mostly in the vocational schools of the state. And they provided the space free, typically.
Mm-hmm.
They liked it and we liked it pretty much. There were tensions, but all in the main. The first freestanding building, hence campus, came with the creation of, with Henry Arnsbrock in Marathon County.
Wausau.
That's right.
Yeah.
Henry and his supporters there, working with Adolphson and with Hanley, were able to, they got enabling legislation introduced into the legislature for allowing counties to spend county money in creating a university center, mm-hmm. and providing for the universities to provide for the instruction. There was a division of responsibilities there. The first year, I can't tell you what year that was, you probably have it there. The first legislation was imperfect, it needed correcting, so they had to wait a year to get that revised, and then it passed and was signed. And then the building was built up there, the first building was built. Now that building was built in Elvium's time. I remember going to the inauguration with Adolphson and Dewey and
So that's 1960, I think.
Right. Yeah, I think 1960 is the year. That was the first freestanding building, and then there was a rush of, there was a whole rush to build other, on other campuses, mm-hmm. Get their own structures. Yeah. After that, but Henry Arnsbrock's efforts were pioneering efforts in that regard. Yeah, let's see, what were we were talking about Bill Hanley, and I had said that I think maybe in locating campuses, but it's not so much in locating them de novo, but rather deciding which ones of those myriad campuses which had blossomed after World War II to accommodate the returning veteran, which ones of those remained and stayed in place. I think those are decisions that very largely were made by Bill.
I see, yeah.
You better ask someone else, though, to see who knew more about that. That preceded my coming, because by the time I got here in 1950, there were those 9 and then 8, if you drop Fond du Lac. But someone else may have a perspective on how those were shaped down. Now, prior to World War II, and when the centers were created, there was a real rash of building. I think they might have gotten up to about 34 at one time. Freshman programs or freshman-sophomore programs hither and yon throughout the state. The first center was created in Antigo, I think, in 1932, but that was a response to the Depression. Mm-hmm. This other rash of centers was a response to the returning veteran and the need to accommodate him for a beginning collegiate experience.
Well, let's call it quits now.
Yeah, right. That was sort of rambling. You might want